Looking for the last couple weeks at an ancient story, the story of Naomi and Ruth, and it is a story about who we are in times of crisis. It's a story about who gets a place at our table and who doesn't. It's a story about a well-worn human pattern, a well-worn human instinct, and that is that in times of crisis, it is our way to circle the wagons and to band together closely with people who look and think and act like we do, our people. We do it again and again and again through history. We find some kind of an adversary to be them to our us. And what that does is it helps us strengthen our bonds with one another, and in so doing, to mitigate the fear that the crisis then generates. But as we've seen in this lesson, it's a bad deal. It gains us a short-term benefit, but it sacrifices a long-term benefit. We end up living in a smaller truth, and the smaller truths are not the truest truths. And so we end up suffering the consequences of our short-sightedness. Because, as we've been seeing, our biggest truths tell us that we really are in this thing together. That oneness is a better description of reality than two-ness. Them is an illusion. We are all us. So, in the last couple weeks, I've told the story of Naomi and Ruth, and I've given a lot of historical background to help us gain a better understanding of what's actually going on in this story. And I told the story of a depression study that was conducted for several years with women in London. And I told another story about a neighborhood in Berlin, Kotti. And each one of those stories has reinforced this fundamental idea, that deep, authentic connections are essential to human well-being. Deep, authentic connections are essential to human well-being. And the connections that we make with the other are often the most essential, the most healing, the most transformative. And that's because a lot of our fear, a lot of our anxiety, a lot of our depression comes from the alienation that we experience primarily from the other. Our disconnection from and our fear of the other has a power over us. And so consequently, the other has a power over us that our people do not. When our connections transcend sameness, when our connections transcend usness, when our connections are made with those that are actually the source of our anxiety and our alienation, those connections have a profound capacity to heal what ails us. Because it's pretty easy to see as a society that alienation and isolation are ailing us. Separation and othering are ailing us. Depression and anxiety are ailing us. We've been looking at the staggering numbers. It's an epidemic. Now, we might feel immune to disconnectedness, and this might be something that we think of as a problem of people out there. But that's the thing. We are in this thing together. Failing to heed that ancient wisdom about a bigger and bigger version of us, about this notion of oneness, if we ignore that ancient wisdom, it does diminish us and it does damage us. Because when the other is diminished, it has an effect on us. When the other is hurting, it has an effect on us. We cannot be separate from the suffering of the other. So that's where we've been. That's what we've been talking about. We did all that history around the story of Ruth and Naomi. That's where we've been. Today, I'm going to unpack that story a little bit more, and I'm going to say again that deep, authentic connections are essential to human well-being, and connections with the other are often the most essential. And I will talk about a little bit about what happens to us when we don't make connections, and its corollary point, what's happening to our society, because startling numbers of us are not making personal connections. For that part of today, I'll draw from this book by Robert Putnam. He's the guy who wrote Bowling Alone. And then at the end of the lesson, I've got an 8-minute video I'm going to show you about some people who are doing something about this seemingly overwhelming problem that is gutting our nation and is really gutting Western civilization. There's a group right in Durham, close by to us, doing something to heal this destructive wound in our world that in ways that, as we've been saying, are here, now, small, doable, ways that we can participate in. So, some more remarks to kind of unpack the story of Naomi and Ruth, and then a video about not being powerless in the face of this daunting challenge. So, isolation and loneliness that often comes with isolation hangs over our culture like a fog. As we saw last week, it is a causal force. It's not just a correlative force. It's a causal force in this epidemic of depression and epidemic of anxiety that we as a nation are suffering. It turns out that isolation, being cut off from others, and the loneliness that attends that, it affects us. It affects our minds. It affects our souls. It affects our bodies. In a study that was run over a large group of people, they were given three things. They were given a timer, they were given a cardiovascular monitor, and they were given some tubes to spit in. And so when the timer went off, and it went off 9 times a day, they recorded their perceived sense of loneliness on a scale of 1 to 10, and then they recorded their heart rate, and then they spit in a tube, and they labeled the time of day. Now, the data was strong. It's kind of what we'd expect, given what we've been talking about in the lesson so far. When those in the study were feeling lonely, their level of hormones, stress hormones, and in particular cortisol, began to soar. That's what they found when they would spit in the tube. Acute loneliness, it turns out, creates a hormonal stress response that is equivalent to the hormonal stress response we have when we have been physically attacked. So, in other words, loneliness and being mugged have the same physical stress response. In another experiment, students in university agreed to rub cold germs on their noses. Factoring out as many variables as the study could, people who felt relationally isolated were 3 times more likely to catch the cold than those who felt relationally connected. Loneliness degrades our immune systems. In a series of meta-studies, that's studies of multiple studies, there's a straight line correlation between the rates of illness, the rates of premature death, the rates of anxiety and depression, and the level of isolation and loneliness that a given society has over multiple societies studied. And as we saw earlier in this lesson, our own nation is experiencing an epidemic of isolation. We have a tremendous amount of alienation and isolation and aloneness. Now, because insurance companies end up paying for the consequences of this epidemic, they are studying isolation closely. Cigna does an annual survey. They call it the Loneliness Index. And in the 2018 Loneliness Index, 46% of Americans reported feeling alone sometimes or always, reported not having significant, meaningful connections in their life sometimes or always. 27% of Americans said they never feel like they have someone who understands them, 1/4 of us. Only 27% of us, leaving 3/4, 27% of us rarely do not belong to a group of friends. They have no connecting social environment. And only 24% of us say we can find companionship when we want it. 20% of Americans rarely feel close to other people. Only 53% have a meaningful face-to-face in-person contact with anyone on a daily basis. Now, for those between the ages of 18 and 22, 60% feel left out, feel isolated. For those 23 to 37, it drops a little bit, but only by 5%. 55% feel left out, feel isolated. Now, those are numbers. But you and I and our whole society pays a steep price for those numbers, because those numbers bring about negative health outcomes. Those numbers produce lonely kids who shoot up schools. Those numbers produce people who find the other in another racial group and end up defining hatred as a part of our social life together. Those numbers affect our bodies. Those numbers affect our minds. Those numbers affect our hearts. And those numbers affect our society. They are numbers, but they represent real people who experience real alienation, real outgrouping, real isolation. And real people do real things, like shoot up schools and shoot up synagogues and churches. Real people do real things, like becoming miserable bosses or coworkers. Real people do real things, like becoming spiteful husbands and caustic wives and distracted parents and mean-spirited siblings. Real people do real things, like becoming entrenched, non-listening, non-cooperating citizens. And real people do real things, like spreading depression and fear and anxiety around so that we all get a share. Now, this epidemic makes sense because this dynamic happens in our bodies. Alienation and isolation and loneliness happen in our minds. It is part of how we are wired. We evolved out there on the savannas of Africa to live in hunter-gatherer bands between several dozen and several hundred. We learned how to cooperate, or we died. And if we died, we didn't pass along our genes. And so the genes that we have inherited are be-together genes. They are look-after-our-sick genes. They are work-together-so-we-can-all-eat genes. And if we ever become separated from the group, then if we were alone for a protracted period of time, we were then vulnerable to predators, and our bodies sent us danger signals so that we would survive and pass along our genes. The signals were, hey, if you're going to get sick out here, nobody's going to take care of you. The signals were, hey, it's dangerous out here. This is a threat. And so consequently, our brains have evolved to send regular, urgent signals to our bodies. Get back to the group. Whatever it takes, get back to the group. So there's a direct link between isolation and the feeling of dread. Aloneness triggers a high alert response because something bad is going to happen. It also shuts down our relaxation and recovery response. Our history as a species has fashioned into our lives a dynamic that makes us feel good when we are connected, to feel secure when we are connected, and to feel bad when we are isolated, to feel insecure and threatened, to go into hypervigilant mode, and to be stressed when we are isolated. A sleep study that was conducted by a strict sect of the Amish in North Dakota looked at what is becoming one of our nation's bigger problems, and that is sleep difficulties. In particular, this study was looking at micro-awakenings, very small, quick awakenings that happen. You know, we go through about an hour and a half process of sleep, and we go through it several times through the course of the night, and we go through five different levels of sleep in each one of these hour and a half processes. But what the micro-awakenings do is they come and they keep us going into the depth of sleep that is so restorative that we need. And so they were studying these micro-awakenings. And it's not particularly surprising, given what we've seen, there's a direct correlation between our isolation and the frequency of these micro-awakenings, which again makes sense from an evolutionary perspective because we weren't safe sleeping alone on the savanna. And for thousands of gene-passing years, we weren't safe if we slept disconnected or isolated. Nobody had our back, so of course our brain wouldn't let us relax and restore. Well, this Amish sect in North Dakota had one of the lowest levels of loneliness that had ever been studied, and they were actually kind of funny in the way they talked about it. Yeah, that's not our problem. We're just a little bit too much up in each other's business. But also, without being surprising, they had the lowest levels of these micro-awakenings that had been studied. Now, that's a problem for us, because in our nation and in the West overall, for several decades now, we have had a marked decline in community involvement. It started way back in the 1930s when the automobile allowed us to isolate ourselves and begin to move away from community. But it was particularly accelerated since the dawn of the internet, you know, the last 25, 30 years. So we have stopped being together at an incredible rate. We stay in our homes more than ever before. Our collective rates of community making and friendship making has been plummeting. All of our technologies facilitate a toxic American individualistic instinct to stay alone. You can order your groceries now. You don't even have to go to the grocery store alone. You can do your shopping. You don't have to participate in commerce alone. We can do things alone now that we never could do alone before. And we are taking advantage of those things. Now, by the way, that's not a bad thing. I got to tell you, I really like being able to order groceries in my pajamas. I'm just saying that there is something that we lose, and we have to figure out how to get that thing back. In one annual survey, Americans are asked on an annual basis how many close confidants they have. 3 decades ago, the most common answer to that question was 3. I have 3 close confidants. In 2004, the most common answer was 0. I have 0 close confidants. More Americans have 0 close confidants than any other number. And we've stopped being with our families as well. We eat together far less frequently. We watch television together far less frequently. We go on vacation together far less frequently. And it is affecting us, and it is affecting our bodies and our minds and our relationships and our spirituality. It is affecting our society. It's affecting the resilience that we bring to adversity. So it's affecting us, and it's affecting those around us. It's affecting our next-door neighbors. And it's affecting our bosses and our coworkers. And it's affecting the kids who go to school with our kids. And it's affecting the teachers who teach our kids. And it's affecting the leaders who lead our social institutions. It's affecting us. A dense web of people around us has evaporated. And our sense of belonging has shriveled. We feel homesick sometimes, even when we're at home. Isolated rats get breast cancer tumors 84 times more than communal rats. In brain scans, isolated people can spot a threat in 150 milliseconds. Connected people spot a threat in 300 milliseconds, twice as long, which means that disconnected people mount a threat response much earlier and live in that threat response much longer than connected people, and over time, that constant threat response kills us. Isolated people are more likely to take offense when no offense is intended. Isolated people receive more criticism than connected people, and they are less able to handle that criticism than connected people. Isolated people become harder to be around, which then just reinforces the cycle of greater isolation. We human beings languish when we don't share meaningful experiences with one another, when we don't share meaningful connections with one another. And we Americans are swimming in a sea of isolation from meaningful connections. Now again, maybe you have a rich tapestry of meaningful relationships. As I said last week, for goodness sakes, we've been working on that hard enough at NRCC for a long time, encouraging one another to make a network of spiritual friendships, deep and meaningful relationships. But maybe, like many Americans, your instincts are betraying you, and you are zigging toward isolation instead of zagging toward connection. Either way, the story of Naomi and Ruth, it speaks to us. The story about the women in London speaks to us. The story about the neighborhood of Kauti speaks to us. The troubling statistics I just went through speak to us. And they tell us that we need to move against the trend. We need to institute countercultural instincts. We need to create a healthy environment for our lives. And we need to invite others into that same healthy environment. Because as we've seen, even if we are blessed with our own sphere of connectedness, if those around us are not, not only will them suffer, us suffer too. The us-them dynamic is a toxic one. We are all connected. Oneness is a better description of reality than two-ness. We are all in this thing together. Now, here's a thing that you may have noticed over the last several years of our community life. We have begun to explore these big social themes together and talk about how our spirituality and how our tradition bears upon political division and racial division, how we are going to think about restoring a religious tradition that has become ill. And here's the thing, though. You cannot explore these big themes together and then see them and understand them and then not do something in response and not suffer the consequences of that. Because if you study what's going on and then don't do something in response to that, it is bad for your soul. It triggers and enforces despair. It disheartens us. It defeats us, and it breeds despondence. Now, it's a perfectly legitimate response to make an honest assessment of our lives and conclude that, yes, that thing is important, but right now all my bandwidth is going to this also important thing. And so for me, for now, it's a not now response. That is perfectly legitimate. But when that's not the case, we cannot afford the most common response. And the most common response is this: oh, wow, that is overwhelming. The most common response is, I mean, just look at those numbers. 50, 60% of my peers, all of that isolation, all of that aloneness, all of that alienation, and I feel so small and I feel so inadequate. Here's what I'll do. I'll just shut down and I'll do nothing. We cannot do that. It's bad for our souls. So, as a community, we work really hard to take these big, overwhelming themes like this one and break them down into yeast-size invitations to bring about change. You hear this all the time. What can we do that is here, now, small, doable? Here, now, small, doable. Now, you can find those things on your own, in your neighborhood, in your home, in your kids' school, at your job. You don't have to wait. But what we've been working to do together is to break things like racial division down to something that is accessible, here, now, small, doable. To break political division and these tremendous rates of divorce going on in our county, 7 divorces for every 10 marriages, revitalizing our Sikh religion, and to break those things down in a way that is accessible for us to participate in a yeast-like way, small, here now, small, doable. No one of us does more than we can do, but all of us act as a yeast, each one doing our small part. Now, as you've been hearing, we've been engaging with other spiritual communities looking to break down some of this isolation, bridging the divides that separate us, especially our spiritual communities. On January 13th, it's a Sunday, in the late afternoon, you're going to be invited to a potluck. And each of us will be paired up with someone from either St. Ambrose or Watts Chapel, and we will have a guided conversation with one person from another community, a community that doesn't look like ours, a community that probably doesn't believe like ours. And this video that I'm going to show you talks about another group in Durham that started doing that process 20 years ago. They've been picking away at this problem of isolation. They've been picking away at this problem that we saw in the neighborhood of Kati, that everyone in their own home felt like it was just my problem and didn't realize that it is all of our problems. They have been working like many, many yeasts. Here now, small, doable. And together, they have been able to heal many of the wounds of isolation. Together, they've been able to restitch the torn fabric of community and to do something about the epidemic of isolation and depression and anxiety and aloneness in our nation. It's an IAF group. There are many IAF groups. We're starting one in Wake County right now. Theirs is a group of Spanish-speaking congregations. It is the North Carolina Congress of Latino Congregations, Associations, Organizations. Yeah. So, watch this video. So many of the people in that neighborhood reported, when I was alone in my house, I thought it was just my problem. I thought I was the bad father. I thought it was my fault that I had lost the job. I thought, and we begin to realize that when we connect to one another, we are connected to one another. Oneness is a truer version of reality than two-ness. And so my hope is that we participate in breaking down these things that are destroying us, and we become agents of restitching the torn fabric of community. So Holy Spirit, may it be so in us, may it be so among us, and may it flow through us to our city, to our county, where we can be part of the solution, healing what is wounding us so deeply as we follow Jesus. Amen.